Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president's threat, which Trump issued after meeting with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, to withhold aid to the Palestinians because they snubbed Vice President Pence during his recent visit to Israel. Khalid El-Gindi, a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and is the author of the forthcoming book Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama, joins us. We'll discuss Trump's abandonment of any pretense that the U.S. is an honest broker in bringing about peace between Israelis and Palestinians, and his blithe disregard for the consequences of his actions in recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, which Vice President Pence further aggravated by declaring before Israel's Knesset last week that the U.S. would move its embassy to Jerusalem next year. Then we'll assess the damage that Trump's tariffs on imported solar panels will do in reducing jobs in the fastest-growing job category in what is the world's fastest-growing energy industry, with solar attracting over $160 billion in investments in 2017. Tyson Slocum, the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, joins us to discuss how Trump, who listens to the disgraced coal baron and head of Murray Energy, has moved to throttle the clean energy of the future while he tries to revive the dirty energy of the past, coal. We'll look into how raising the cost of solar will also affect U.S. research and development in promising new solar technologies that will reduce the costs of solar even further. Then, finally, we'll get an update on the twists and turns of the Mueller investigation, as every day brings more and more revelations, with the latest the possibility that transcripts of Donald Trump Jr.'s testimony to Congress might expose him to charges of perjury. Stephen Harper, a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer, joins us to discuss his comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story, which he has compiled at billmoyers.com, and how difficult it is to keep updating information as more shoes drop every day while the Republicans frantically manufacture their alternative reality as they wage war on the DOJ and the FBI. And joining us now is Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously serves as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations in November of 2007. His forthcoming book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khalid El-Gindi. Well, thank you for joining us, Khalid. And it seems somewhat ironic to me that today at Davos, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that there is no substitute for the United States to broker a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, when all of the evidence since Donald Trump has taken office, with both him, his ambassador to Israel, his special envoy, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his embrace of Netanyahu, his change in the historic position the U.S. has had on not having its embassy in Israel, in Jerusalem, which is what all the countries on the planet adhere to. And yet he's sort of acting as though that has nothing to do with it, that his actions, that somehow or other the Palestinians are just being obstinate.
Well, right. I think you hit on really the kind of fundamental paradox of the American role in the peace process for at least for the last quarter century or so. And that is, it's true, the United States is seen as the only party with the prestige and the power and the influence, to broker an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. But at the same time, it is also uniquely hampered by its own domestic politics from doing exactly that. And that is the fundamental paradox that we've been stuck with since before President Trump. Trump has kind of represents, I think, the culmination of this process, where you have these contradictions that have been embedded in U.S. policy for so long have finally kind of played themselves out. You can only maintain these contradictions for so long, and then either, you know, something has to give. And in this case, instead of being corrected, the policy was simply replaced.
Well, given that Trump is basically saying that he's going to cut off aid to the Palestinians through the UN Refugee Agency, and because they snubbed Vice President Pence, saying, when they disrespect us a week ago by not allowing our great vice president to see them, and we give them hundreds of millions of dollars in aid and support, tremendous numbers, numbers that nobody understands. That money is on the table, and that money is not going to them unless they sit down and negotiate peace. So that's basically what he's, I mean, in other words, you know, it's all about snubbing a vice president who spoke to, again, to the Knesset, which had never happened before with a U.S. vice president, and the Palestinian Israelis walked out, and Pence basically promised that he'd move the embassy even sooner to Jerusalem. So again, the expectation is that the U.S. is free to insult the Palestinians and basically say you don't matter anymore. At the same time, they act indignant when the Palestinians get upset. I don't get it.
I think that's it's partly, you know, the kind of baggage that Trump has inherited. For a very long time, the approach with the Palestinians has been pretty much reliant on sticks, whereas the approach with the Israelis was the exact opposite. It was one of all carrots. There was, of course, the massive military aid and other benefits in the diplomatic relationship between the two countries. The United States committed to shielding Israel from criticism at the United Nations. And so it has been all about providing Israel with assurances and reassurance and lots of carrots. Precisely the opposite approach with the Palestinians. What Donald Trump has done is basically sort of a caricature of what has been essentially the U.S. Posture toward Palestinians, which is one really that relies on pressure and coercion and arm twisting. Again, precisely the opposite of its relationship with Israel. And so what you end up having is the United States as a broker has essentially been putting less pressure on the stronger party and more pressure on the weaker party, which is precisely the opposite of what a normal mediator is supposed to do in terms of trying to level the playing field to give both sides an incentive and the ability to change the dysfunctional dynamic of a conflict. And so that hasn't been the approach thus far of leveling the playing field, and it therefore also not surprising that it hasn't worked. Trump has just simply exaggerated that approach. And at the same time, part of this paradox of the American role is that he is, by withdrawing aid from Palestinian refugees and by recognizing Jerusalem, he's taken away American leverage on these two very important issues, which is precisely the incentive that Palestinians had for being in an American-led peace process. And so if you've now removed the incentives, the potential carrots for Palestinians, and you resort exclusively to the use of sticks, threats, and cutting off aid and what have you, then you've all but ensured that the Palestinians cannot come back to an American-led peace process. And which is, you know, it's very problematic for the Palestinian leadership, because their entire strategy for the last three decades has relied exclusively on an American-led peace process. And so they're scrambling now to try to redefine their strategy, and they may not be able to.
And again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations in November of 2007. And his forthcoming book is Blind Spot: America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama. So is this to say then, Khaled, that is this a basically perhaps even a more honest, because let's face it, Trump is completely on board with Netanyahu. They really get on like a house on fire. The son-in-law, Kushner, would give up his bedroom every time Netanyahu stayed with the family, their old family friends. The ambassador is completely tight with the Israeli right, as all of the Trump people are. The UN ambassador is now criticizing the Palestinian leader because he was angry at Trump. How dare you be angry at Trump? I mean, the whole thing is pathetic, admittedly. But when you had people like Dennis Ross, who are pretending to be the honest brokers, when they were in the bag for Israel as well, Dennis Ross was often described as Israel's lawyer, then maybe it's about time we got real. Not that that's to suggest that there's a path forward.
Well, I think that is probably very much in line with where the Palestinian public is and has been for some time. There's been a lot of dissatisfaction with their leadership because of its continued reliance on the United States, even before Donald Trump's election. You know, there were signs back, you know, more than a decade ago, under President George W. Bush and even through the Obama administration. The Palestinian public has pretty much long ago given up on the idea of an American-led peace process, and have been unhappy with their own leadership for relying on it. Now that the leadership itself has been burned by this relationship, that really, really undercuts their standing considerably at home. And I think one of the consequences, or one of the potential consequences of Trump's decision and his entire approach to this issue, is that it could end up causing this Palestinian leadership to collapse. So if you have, I mean, it's you know, this is what I refer to as the blind spot in the book. There isn't any real sense of how American diplomacy and repeated failures in the peace process and inability to pressure Israel affects Palestinian politics and affects the legitimacy of a Palestinian leader. If the focus is only on having a leader sign a piece of paper called a peace agreement, and it doesn't have any political or public support, that's not a very worthwhile endeavor. And so, you know, there needs to be much more attention paid to how U.S. politics or how U.S. policy affects the legitimacy of a leader. Because right now, Mahmoud Abbas is faced with a choice: either I lose my own people, or I lose the United States. Either way, it's a lose-lose for him, because to go into a peace process without any legitimacy or mandate by his people would be meaningless as far as, you know, diplomatically. And at the same time, to completely shun the United States results in what we have now, just hostility and acrimony, but with no real. I mean, there's nothing good that can come out of this approach that the Trump administration has taken.
Well, the Trump administration has basically getting on board the Israeli right's attitude, which Netanyahu reflects, and he's always looking over his right shoulder because a lot more politicians are even further to the right than him. And that is basically, it's my way or the highway. And that's the attitude that they have to anybody who criticizes Israel. You know, you either are an anti-Semite or you're, you know, this criticism of the boycott movement. They're even going after groups like Jewish Voices for Peace. So they're basically saying there's only one narrative and it's our narrative. And it's kind of a thuggish attitude, which Trump has adopted. There's no nuance in it. And I guess the Israeli left and the peace movement is all but extinct. So what is the possibility? Can the Europeans carry the ball for the Palestinians, or are they basically on their own?
I think for the moment, the Palestinians are on their own. It's not just the United States and Europe that aren't really in their corner. Even the Arab states, you know, even their traditional strategic base in the Arab world is really not there as far as Arab leaders. I've been very ambivalent towards Mahmoud Abbas and his leadership, and to a certain extent indifferent toward the Palestinian issue. That doesn't necessarily reflect where public opinion is in Arab countries, but that's where the Arab states are and their leaders. And so the Palestinians really are on their own. The problem, as I mentioned, is that Palestinian politics is dysfunctional. It's fragmented and divided. As I see it, probably nothing could happen at the political or diplomatic level before Palestinians are able to fix their own house first. But relying on the United States or Europe or even the Arab states at this stage, when their own house is in such disarray, I think would be a mistake.
Well, let's stay in touch. It's obviously the Palestinians have been in limbo for decades, and it's obvious they have a dysfunctional political system with a split between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. They seem to be able to shoot themselves in the foot regularly. Again, they're up against a very obstinate Israel that's now joined by a very obstinate U.S. So it's a pretty bleak picture. I thank you for joining us, Khaled El-Gindi.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who is a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November 2007. And his forthcoming book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how Trump is trying to throttle the clean energy of the future, solar, while he tries to revive the dirty energy of the past, coal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tyson Slocum, who is the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, where he works to promote stronger regulation of energy markets, examine the impact of mergers and lax regulations over electricity, petroleum, and natural gas, and monitor federal legislation on energy issues. He conducts extensive research on the influence of corporate special interests on our political system and works to promote corporate and government accountability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tyson Slocum.
Always great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you. And in the State of the State address today, the Governor Jerry Brown, as his tenure ends, mentioned that the only person who's against making advances in alternative energy, in particular solar, and dealing with climate change is the non-believer in the existence of climate change in the White House. And the non-believer in the greatest and gravest danger facing the planet in the White House has now slapped tariffs on solar, which for a guy that keeps talking about he's the job creator, solar is the fastest growing job creator in the country. Solar is the world's fastest growing energy industry, attracting over $160 billion in investment in 2017. So is this just an act of stupidity on the part of the president in slapping tariffs on solar and washing machines, which are going to kill advances in solar? And we also know that Trump is trying to bring back coal at the same time. So,
yeah, it's not going to be a surprise to your listeners that President Trump did another stupid thing. And this tariff decision is a stupid thing. We all want to see more solar panels manufactured in the United States, but slapping tariffs on foreign-made solar panels isn't the right course of action, especially because it is combined, as you alluded to, Ian, with other efforts by the Trump administration to promote coal and nuclear at the expense of solar and wind. So it would be one thing if Trump was saying, listen, we want to give U.S. solar manufacturers a leg up, and we're going to do that by, A, limiting foreign-made solar panels, and, B, providing all of the needed incentives to significantly grow solar demand in the United States by promoting more rooftop solar, utility-scale solar, and things like that. But that's not what Trump is doing. He's doing a completely idiotic move where he is limiting foreign-made solar panels at the same time that his Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, made a formal rulemaking procedure at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to force consumers to spend billions of dollars every year to subsidize uneconomic coal and nuclear power plants. And those power plants have been made uneconomic by the wave of cheap solar energy that's growing across the country.
Well, my understanding is that even though a lot of manufacturing has moved abroad and most of it comes from China and South Korea, the U.S. still has the technological superiority in R&D to find the most efficient solar panels, and a lot of American companies have them manufactured abroad. But my understanding is that this boneheaded move by President Trump will actually hurt R&D, because there's some very promising R&D with new solar materials that are almost like, you know, slapping on a coat of paint and having it generate electricity. So I'm speaking of perovskite. So tell me about whether this is going to have an impact on R&D and solar.
Well, yeah, it's going to have an impact on R&D. I mean, right now, about 15% of solar panels sold in the United States are manufactured in the United States. So definitely the vast majority are manufactured outside the United States. And this tariff action alone is probably going to depress U.S. solar installations by about 11% over the next 5 years. So it's not catastrophic, but it's definitely going to have a negative impact. I think the more important thing that we need to be focusing on is how can the United States become the global leader in renewable energy? Because we are losing ground to other countries. And I think if you look at what Germany did beginning in the 1980s and 1990s, the way that Germany stimulated domestic solar manufacturing was by stimulating domestic solar demand. And they did that by providing generous incentives to people to generate electricity from rooftop solar. And so as a result, Germany had more installed solar capacity than the United States, right? Which is crazy because geographically it's smaller, population-wise it's smaller, and it's at a far more northern latitude than the United States. We don't need to replicate Germany's expensive domestic subsidies because right now solar is cost competitive and often the least cost energy fuel source in most American markets. But we do need to make sure that solar and customers seeking to install solar don't have any impediments artificially erected by local utilities or other stupid regulations. And so what we should be doing is pioneering the becoming leaders in domestic solar manufacturing by vastly expanding solar opportunities in the domestic market. And that's not what Trump is doing. Simply slapping tariffs on foreign-made solar is a clumsy, nonsensical move to try and help U.S. manufacturing. It's not going to get the job done. It's counterproductive.
But we've suggested that so far it's all about Trump being stupid. But maybe it's not entirely that. Maybe Trump is acting at the behest of some of his big donors. Coal and nuclear and oil and gas were big donors. Koch brothers are huge.
Bob Murray has the ear of the president. And your listeners need to know who Bob Murray is. He's the CEO of Murray Energy, which is America's largest privately held coal mining company. And Bob Murray this summer gave $1 million in cash to Trump's super PAC to support Trump in all sorts of ads and other electoral activities. And Bob Murray, at the same time that he delivered this $1 million in cash to Donald Trump, was meeting with Donald Trump. He was meeting with Secretary Perry. And it was Bob Murray who, in memos that have been obtained by reporters, outlined a plan that Rick Perry, Trump's Secretary of Energy, later introduced in September, a plan to force consumers across the country to spend billions of dollars to provide subsidies to underperforming coal-fired power plants. So absolutely, when I look at the Trump administration, I see crony capitalism at its worst. And what I see is Bob Murray's fingerprints all over Donald Trump's failing energy and climate policies.
So it's then quite likely that this is a very cynical move to kill off the fastest growing job creator, the fastest growing sector in the world in terms of energy. And as I mentioned in the beginning, it's attracted over $160 billion in investment since 2017. And, you know, it could also precipitate a trade war. That's another issue in itself. So from what you're telling me, this is not about Trump being stupid and reactionary and atavistic, but simply corrupt.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's stupid. He is foregoing what's in the national interest to pursue the narrow special interests of coal. And so that is dumb. It's deeply cynical. And the important thing to understand is we're not going to let this happen, right? Public Citizen and other organizations are fighting hard to stop these cynical, destructive moves by the Trump administration. I testified before Congress about some of these issues this past fall, and on the panel with me was the head of energy procurement for the Walmart Corporation. And what this person from Walmart told Congress in October was they are almost exclusively securing long-term energy contracts to supply their warehouses and their stores from renewable energy, not because they felt it was the moral thing to do, but because every time Walmart went into the open market to solicit bids, renewable energy came in the cheapest. And that's really the revolution that we're seeing right now. And it's so typical that Trump is completely out of step with what's going on in the marketplace. Of course, renewable energy is good to fight climate change. Of course, it's good for the environment relative to fossil fuels. But it's also increasingly the least cost option, especially compared to fossil fuels like coal. And so coal has been dying in the marketplace not because of regulations, but because renewable energy has become so efficient that it is cheaper than coal. There was a funny story last year where the National Coal Museum in Kentucky installed solar panels on their museum because it was cheaper than buying electricity from the local utility that was primarily fueled by coal. So even the National Coal Museum relies on solar power. So this is what we all understand to be the facts. And once again, the Trump administration is bucking the facts in order to pursue policies that were designed by corporate special interests, in this case, Murray Energy and Bob Murray specifically.
But aren't the consequences of Trump's move to slap tariffs on solar likely to raise the cost of solar and make it less competitive?
It will. I mean, you know, there was just some research announced that said that the impact of this tariff is going to result in an 11% reduction in solar installations in the United States over the next 5 years. So that isn't a good number. It's not catastrophic. So basically, without the tariffs, we would have seen, you know, almost 15,000 more solar installations. Now we're just going to see 14,000. So it's in of itself, it's not a good move, but it's not catastrophic. But if it's combined with other Trump administration initiatives like the coal bailout plan or other efforts to limit the ability of states to adequately pursue energy and climate policies that they see as being beneficial, things like California is trying to do, then it is a problem. And so, again, the Trump administration is pursuing bad policy at the behest of big donors and special interests that are completely against what the market wants and what consumers and the climate would benefit from.
So this is a surreal situation, isn't it? If you give Trump money and say nice things to him and tell him how great he is, he'll do anything for you, no matter how terrible your product is.
Right. This is what's so dangerous about a wildly uneducated and misinformed president, is that whoever has his ear, Trump is going to listen to, and he will do things for that person. Bob Murray wrote a memo to the President of the United States that the Associated Press got their hands on this summer, and in this memo, Bob Murray says, "President Trump, I sat with you in your office and told you that these are the things that you need to do to bail out coal, and they haven't been done yet." And so what was clear from these memos was that the president agreed to what Bob Murray wanted, but some of the requests that Bob Murray was asking for, one thing that Bob Murray asked for last year was for the President of the United States to declare a national emergency and essentially federalize all of the underperforming coal-fired power plants, basically nationalizing them in order to keep them operating. It was a completely insane idea. It would have been massively expensive, and White House lawyers actually ran interference. They were like, "Mr. President, this is actually completely insane. We can't do this." But President Trump wanted to do it simply because Bob Murray asked him to. And so that's what's so dangerous is we're only, of all the bad policies we're seeing, we're only seeing a fraction of the things that Trump actually would want to do. It's just that he's got, you know, at least a handful of adults in the room that stop him from doing things even worse. It's an absolutely crazy situation. But when you read things like these Bob Murray memos to the president, it's frightening just how ignorant and impulsive the president is on massive policy issues.
Well, Tyson Slocum, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Tyson Slocum, who's the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, where he works to promote stronger regulation in energy markets, examine the impact of mergers and lax regulations over electricity, petroleum, and natural gas, and monitor federal legislation on energy issues. He conducts extensive research on the influence of corporate special interests on our political system and works to promote corporate and government accountability. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update on the timeline on the Trump-Russia story.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. He blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at billmoyers.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we've spoken earlier, Stephen, but since then, that was several months ago, the timeline that you're doing on the Trump-Russia story, it's happening so thick and fast that I don't know how you keep up. I find it difficult to keep up with Trump's antics, but how are you doing with the timeline now, particularly now that so many bombshells have dropped just in the last couple of days with the judiciary chairman planning to release Donald Trump's junior's transcripts, a couple of members of that committee, Blumenthal and White House, have suggested that, quote, the transcripts of congressional testimony may reveal other and better-founded concerns about witnesses' false statements. In other words, they're responding to what Grassley and Senator Lindsey Graham did in terms of a criminal referral about Steele, the author of the Steele dossier, which the Democrats think is completely bogus. But they're suggesting that there's some real false testimony there, which I imagine in the hands of Mueller could be perjury, right?
Well, I wouldn't want to get out too far ahead of my skis on that one. I certainly am very interested to read that transcript, assuming that it's released fully and not in some redacted version that eliminates the juicy stuff. To your other question, how do you keep track of this stuff? The answer is I'm indefatigable, and I try to focus on it like a laser beam. You know, it's interesting. You thought it felt like it had been several months since we spoke last, and I went back and took a look. It's actually only been 2 months. It just feels like 2 years because everything's happening so quickly. I think the biggest thing, you know, if you had to sum up the really important, in my view, turn that this thing has taken, apart from the fact that since we spoke last, Mike Flynn is now a cooperating witness, which is an enormous development because, you know, as prosecutors and criminal defense lawyers will tell you, you get cooperation from lower level people in order to go higher up the food chain. And above Mike Flynn, there aren't very many people in what was the Trump food chain and still is the Trump food chain. But I'll tell you what concerns me most about, and you referred to it very quite specifically. I'm afraid that what's happening now is a very, and it's been happening now for at least a couple of months, is a very systematic drumbeat chorus of complicity coming from the Republicans in Congress. He's always, you know, we've always had the media voices on his side, the Breitbarts, and so forth. But now we're getting what is just a diversionary circus after the other of GOP, what I call GOP complicity. That's really, you know, the noon stuff relating to the his super secret memo that has yet to see the light of day and probably won't survive scrutiny that the light of day will give it is just the latest example. But this has been an ongoing drumbeat of diversion that I think is GOP Republican complicity that's extraordinarily dangerous. I think it makes it the most dangerous phase yet in terms of what's happening in the overall story.
Well, the most amazing part of this story, though, is, and this ought to be a red flag, and I don't understand what's happening to the Republicans in covering up for Russia and their continuing information campaign against the United States. For example, release the memo, which is this new hashtag trying to get this bogus story out that Nunes is flogging, that the Justice Department had to finally tell him to stop because it's complete manufactured conspiracy. But guess who is pushing this hashtag with bots and trolls?
Yeah, Russia. Absolutely.
It released the memo. It's gone viral. So here you have the Russians, in effect, working hand in glove with Devin Nunes and these other Republicans. What's going on with the Nunezes of the world? What calculus do they have? Why are they abandoning any sense of patriotic duty towards the United States and allowing and working in concert with a hostile foreign power who's already manipulated the last elections? I mean, is it simply the case that they want the Russians to help them win in November and in 2020?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I wish I knew the answer to it. You know, most people operate out of, in some sense anyway, out of self-interest. You like to think that people who enter government service also have a notion of public service lurking at least somewhere in the back of their psyche. But it almost makes you wonder, you know, what does somebody have on some of these guys, frankly, is what it makes you wonder, because it's remarkable. I mean, it's just remarkable. And not only are they aiding and abetting in a very real sense the ongoing, you know, destruction of democratic norms, possibly, you know, in a way that's entirely beyond improper and illegal, but it's they're not going after the foremost law enforcement agency in the world. So now it's not just a matter of defending Trump. It's a matter of defending Trump, even if it requires impugning the integrity of career public servants in the FBI and taking down the reputation of the entire Federal Bureau of Investigation in the process. That is, to me, the most frightening turn that this whole thing has taken. Because if what you're now going to do is you're going to say, look, we're going to pivot the entire discussion. Now we're even further away now from the Christopher Steele stuff. That was bad enough. I mean, that's sort of the ultimate. You know, we don't want to deal with the message, so let's shoot the messenger. But now we're taking it a step further, and we're saying, let's shoot the entire Federal Bureau of Investigation. And that's a stunning prospect to anybody who just thinks back for a moment and reflects on what that could mean in terms of. The forward direction of the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. And he blogs at The Belly of the Beast. And he has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at billmoyers.com. Well, clearly, this misinformation campaign is being directed by Trump. And Trump, of course, was his mentor was Roy Cohn, who taught him how to sort of preemptively attack, sleaze, slime, do whatever it takes. This is typical of the mentality of a criminal, where you, rather than answer the charges against you, you go after those that are making the charges. You try and bully or bribe the authorities into submission and threaten them with lawsuits. And this is effectively what's happening. So The question would be then, why are the Republicans going along with it? What could that be? You mentioned the possibility of that they're compromised. And that raises the interesting question of, we know that when the Russians hacked the DNC, they also hacked the RNC, but they only released the DNC incriminating information via WikiLeaks to hurt the Democrats. But that doesn't mean that they didn't really scour through the RNC data. And Lindsey Graham has also said that the Russians hacked his personal email. So what's going on there? Is there a possibility that the Russians have some dirt on Devin Nunes, for example, and are blackmailing him?
I don't know. I mean, but it certainly makes you wonder, doesn't it? You know, the lengths that they're going to protect by sheer, you know, deflection, diversion, and as I say, attacking the foremost law enforcement agency in the world. I mean, that's beyond a scorched earth. That's beyond scorched earth. That's destroy the planet kind of strategy. And you know, you start knocking away the pillars of law enforcement. You know, it's one thing to say that Trump has been ignorant of or disregarding of the rule of law. It's another thing for him to say that his defenders are willing to take apart the law enforcement institutions that protect all of us. And that's a frightening prospect. And you know, the other thing you're seeing too, that you know, the frame of you know, well, did anybody really do anything wrong? Now this is sort of the other side of the coin. It was sort of telling. There were two things I thought that were telling that came out yesterday, and that is this sort of subtle reframing of what obstruction means. And in that impromptu news conference that Trump gave on January 24th. He said, well, they're talking about obstruction. He says there's no collusion. So did I fight back? Yeah, you fight back, and now they're calling it obstruction. So all of a sudden now it's not just obstruction has morphed into Trump just simply being defensive, which of course is not a defense to things like intimidating witnesses and obstructing justice and so forth. But you can see a very subtle frame of reference. And you saw a reframing, if you will, of the thing. And you see another sort of wordplay with Sarah Sanders when she was asked about collusion. And her comment was to the effect of, well, the question is, did the Russians help Trump win? Well, that's not really quite the question either. I mean, the answer is absolutely they did. There's not even any dispute about that. That's what they wanted to do. But now I guess we're going to this sort of ephemeral notion of, well, maybe Trump didn't care who helped him win, and that's not a crime or something like that. All of which, when you start packaging all of this, it just, as you say, and that's sort of where you started, you know, the timeline has exploded in terms of what's happening on the timeline. And unfortunately, part of what's happening with that explosion is this proliferation of different kinds of shiny objects that are just a continuing distraction. But if people keep coming back to the central themes, you know, obstruction, and if you don't know where to call it, collusion, call it conspiracy, calling aiding and abetting, calling it whatever you call it, violating the campaign finance laws, calling it, you know, being aware of and participating in knowledge of an illegal computer crime. There's lots of stuff here that Trump and his people don't want to talk about because the rhetoric and the words are very unappealing. They're also quite probative.
Well, in that impromptu press conference, which was not filmed, but the audio of it, and you know, of course, one of the problems is there's so many reporters asking questions that it's hard to hear, and he selectively answers them. But he did suggest that he'd be willing to testify before Mueller, and of course, immediately
before the morning sun rose the next day, his lawyer was walking that one back.
Right, right.
That'll be a remarkable thing if it happens. But I guess on that one, I'll just say, you know, let's see what happens.
Right. Well, the fact that the lawyer acted so quickly would indicate that at least those people that are trying to give this guy legal advice don't think he will make the best witness.
Well, I can tell you that a lawyer's worst nightmare is a serial liar. And the one thing that Trump has demonstrated, it's been documented, you know, in every major news publication, you know, over the last month about the number of lies that he has told just since he assumed office. And we know from his prior appearances in sworn testimony in civil cases that his let's just say he has an elusive relationship with the truth.
So back to the possibility that trying to figure out why the Republicans, not all of them, but a lot of them, are just throwing their lot in with Trump and doing everything they can to impugn the independence and integrity of the Justice Department and the FBI. And this will have long-lasting damage. And it
terrible.
But it also may have damage to the Republican Party itself. Remember, this is the party of law and order. And you're not just going after the FBI. You're going after all of the police in this country because they all look to the FBI as a kind of professional model. Don't you think that is happening, that they're really on shaky grounds here by basically, because this is what's going on. A criminal is trying to attack the police because he's proactively trying and preemptively trying to stay out of jail. So is the Republican Party going to be branded as the party against law and order?
Maybe, but, you know, that may be too natural and obvious a consequence. I suspect, and you know, you see some of it in the way, you know, Trump did that appearance in front of the FBI graduating class at Quantico and received what seemed to be a pretty warm reception there. So I assume that the FBI, like any organization, is an organization filled with a very diverse group in terms of the people who support him and don't support him. In terms of the public perception of what he's doing, it's hard for me to imagine anybody looking at this and not saying, wait a minute, this guy's attacking the FBI, but he's so clever about it that he'll stand up and with a straight face, he'll say, as he did to the Quantico graduates of the FBI Academy, I have your back. And there was no asterisk that says, unless you're the director, a deputy director, or somebody who didn't vote for me in the last election. So it's this persistent mixed message, I think, is probably confusing a lot of people. And unfortunately, he's mastered that duality of message kind of approach. But it really is hard for me to imagine, if you think back to the Republican Party, you know, what would Barry Goldwater, for example, think about this? What would Ronald Reagan? How would he respond to this? It's amazing. And you know, the people who are willing to do it, Republicans, as you say, maybe it's just a matter of they fear him, and they want to keep their jobs, or they want to move up into his administration, or maybe there's some other element of self-interest that motivates this. I continue to be baffled. I have to tell you, it's baffling. And I hope that ultimately there is a justice that emerges in all of this through what Robert Mueller is doing that will be, you know, powerful and persuasive, however it comes out, and say to people, okay, look, somebody's looked at taking a really hard look at this, and here's what we found. We already know what he's found in part. He's found, you know, two people who've pled guilty and become cooperating witnesses to what is, if it's plays out the way it seems to be playing out directionally, is the crime of maybe not just the century, maybe of America's existence.
Well, but that may be what the calculus is, that if you ditch Trump now and bring in the good Christian Mike Pence, you may be able to sort of do some damage control, but nobody's going to look particularly good. So I think what they're doing is they're doubling down, figuring out if we can obstruct and obfuscate as much as we can preemptively before Mueller comes out with his, I think, a likely recommendation of impeachment, then the waters, thanks to Rupert Murdoch and others, the waters will be so muddied, 35% of the country won't believe what Mueller is putting out, and they may be able to, with a booming economy and a runaway stock exchange and enough trickle-down delusion to their voters, they may be able to hold on to power.
That's clearly the strategy, although I wouldn't be too quick to think that Pence is going to be off the hook on this. You know, he was head of the transition team, and if you go, for example, even to my timeline and you click on Mike Pence and Mike Flynn, you know, Flynn could be a real problem for Pence. I don't know, you know, what direction Mueller will take in all of this, but remember that Pence was number two on what I call the Putin ticket that won the election. So I wouldn't, you know, and in terms of the substantive question, you know, would the country be better off with Pence than with Trump? I don't even know how to begin to answer that one. But I wouldn't be so quick to assume that Pence at least doesn't have some, shouldn't at least have some concern about what somebody like Mike Flynn might have to say about what Pence knew about a lot of these conversations that were happening, for example, over sanctions involving the Russians during the transition period.
Well, just in closing, back to the possibility that the Republicans are being blackmailed by the Russians, who have all the RNC data. One thing that does come to mind is that there was a meeting some time back with the House Republican leadership and Kevin McCarthy, who's now become Trump's best buddy. He said in that meeting with Paul Ryan and others, he said that, "I swear to God, both Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll." And immediately Paul Ryan said, "Well, wait a minute, let's not talk about that." And they tried to then spin it as being a kind of a joke. But there were independent people in there, including Evan McMullen, the CIA guy that ran for president, who witnessed that exchange. And McCarthy was actually being serious.
So the and the interesting thing about that, when it finally did come out, you know, because Ryan's initial response was, you know, this has got to stay in the family, never leaves the room, don't repeat it. And then when the story started to emerge, initially Ryan's office denied it. And then I can't remember if it was the Washington Post or the New York Times said, "Yeah, well, you know what, we have an audio, we have a transcript, and we have a witness." And sort of with each little iteration of the higher level of proof that they had, eventually they had to acknowledge that, in fact, yes, the conversation did occur. Of course, now they're trying to pass it off as having been a joke. But if you listen to the audio, it doesn't sound like a joke.
Right, and it's pretty clear that Trump's activities with the Russians are suspicious, and that's what Mueller's looking into. And Dana Rohrabacher has been Putin's champion in Congress, so God knows what's going on. But let's hope we learn a little bit more. And one of the ways to learn a lot about it is to go to your timeline, Stephen Harper, because it really needs that kind of clarity where you can look at the whole kind of map of these entanglements, which you untangle. So I thank you for what you do. And how does our audience get hold of your timeline?
Just go to BillMoyers.com. It's right on the landing page. And I'm grateful to you for giving it an airing. You know, the facts get lost. And but for people like you and others and people who will now go to it and look at it and read it and click on a name and see how the name, you know, fits with the various entries, I'd just be another voice whistling into the wind. But it's good to know that there are people that are willing to try to sort through the nonsense and the diversion and the deflection and pay attention.
I thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. And he blogs at The Belly of the Beast, and he has a comprehensive timeline of the Russia-Trump story at BillMoyers.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck.